Okay, welcome back to Gary's Economics. Today we are going to do something different and we're going to have a guest on the channel, an economist for the very first time, one of my favorite economists working today. I very often get asked on this channel, where else can we go to learn about economics? What other stuff can we read? How can we learn more? And there are a lot of economists who I like working today. There's obviously a couple of French guys working on inequality, Piketty and Zucman. But the person who I always recommend, because I think he is the best at writing about economics in a way that is accessible and relatable for ordinary people, is today's guest on the channel. So I'd like to welcome Arjun Chang.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. I think I'll just introduce briefly how we met and how I got to know you. So I quit banking in 2014, and when I came back, I was sort of looking about how can I change the economy. And I didn't really know much about the work getting done in economics today. And I got invited to a small, what can I say, lecture series that he was
That's right,
doing. When was it 2015, perhaps?
15, 16, I forget.
2015, I was invited to a lecture series which you gave to a small audience. And I was lucky to watch a few lectures you gave about how, I think it was, how poor countries become rich. And I was very impressed at the time about basically how you seem to have thought the problems through and delivered answers rather than kind of relying on rigidly mathematical
Oh, that's
models.
very kind of
And I was very impressed at basically how you were just able to communicate ideas in a way that ordinary people would understand. So I was very impressed and I'm very happy to have you as the first guest on
Thank
the
you.
channel.
Yeah, actually, those lectures have been made into this lecture series called Economics for People, and available on INET website, Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Yes, I sometimes get people tweet photos of me asking you a question, saying, "Oh, here's
That's right. You ask
Gary's
some sharp
economics,
questions,
looking younger and fresher, less jaded by politics." So, would you be able to introduce yourself a little to the audience, talk a little bit about why you chose to study economics, when you started, why you chose to move to the UK to study? Because I know this is not where you're from originally.
That's right. I'm Arjun Chang. I'm a professor at SOAS, University of London, at the moment. I used to teach in Cambridge for over 3 decades. I moved to SOAS recently. Yes, I was born in South Korea in 1963. That was right at the beginning of the country's so-called economic miracle. And yeah, really, it was where I grew up and when I grew up that I wanted to study economics because, at the time, South Korea was growing at like 10%, 12%, sometimes at 15%.
This is when you were sort of in your teens,
That's right,
in the
in the 60s
70s.
and 70s, and I mean, people's living standards were rising really rapidly, and the new buildings going up, new towns that forming. Yeah, so there were a lot of good things going on then, because at that level of income, the South Korea's income, per capita income, for example, in the early 1970s, when I was a primary school student, was like $400.
Yes,
So
I
it was a
think,
very poor country, which meant that this economic growth really that was literally a matter of life and death. Because at that level of development, if your economy grows at that 5% rather than 1%, it means that you eat one more bowl of rice.
So
And
was it still like a very agricultural economy at that time?
at the time, but 60, 50, 60% of people were in the countryside, engaged in farming. But also because the country was industrializing rapidly, literally millions of people were arriving in the Seoul, the capital city, and Busan, Ulsan, these the industrial cities in the southeast, to find jobs in factories. But the life was very hard for the workers, because this was a time when these workers are working 13, 14 hours a day, 6.5 days a week.
In factories, in cities.
And Some factories refuse to serve soup in the canteen so that they don't have to give extra toilet break to
Okay.
the. No, that is a very, very harsh time.
Yeah.
But things were improving. On the other hand, you had these workers being worked to death and the slums springing up in urban areas, and then the
Okay.
property developers mobilizing these thugs to beat people up to clear illegal
So
settlements.
you've
And
got this rapidly urbanizing and like growth is high, incomes are growing, but living standards are still really poor for a lot of people, and
that's
the
right.
cities are growing in sort of slum
Yeah,
fashion.
exactly. And then there were a lot of tension because the country was between 1961 and 87 ruled by a military dictatorship. Even though this military government was able to engineer this rapid economic development, it was very brutal. And as I grew up, I just wanted to understand what's going on around me. Yeah,
And
because
you were growing up in like a middle class family or in Seoul?
that's right. Yeah, my father was a high-ranking civil servant in the Ministry of Finance, and we are not rich, but well off. Yeah,
I guess by the standards of a career which was quite poor at the time.
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
Yeah.
so when I was a kid, our house was the only house in the neighborhood with a TV,
Okay, yeah.
so people went to the came to our house to watch a football match, a boxing match, and
So you were witnessing, I guess it sounds like, a period of really rapid economic change and economic growth, and like that interested you and
That's right.
excited
Yeah, so
you.
there were a lot of positive things happening, but also a lot of negative things. Yeah, I mean that this
Okay.
exploitation of workers,
Yeah.
political repression,
It's interesting to hear you talk about the rapidly growing cities and the rapidly growing slums, because obviously at the moment we have a government that is obsessed with growth and they want to build, they want to build, they want to build. And I come from like a very poor part of East London, and I'm seeing, I'm sure it's not the same, but I'm seeing this like rapid growth of these poorer outer London suburbs and basically turning into slums. Yeah, and I was saying before, the Daily Mail went to my house last week, and I think they wanted to do like the house I grew up in, and they wanted to do a story like, oh, Gary said he was poor, but he's actually not. And the story they actually wrote was, oh my God, this place is this slum. You're gonna believe it. So it's interesting to see, and I often worry that this rapid like move for growth will lead to the slumification of London.
No, I mean, though, because that I mean, it was worse in Korea at the time because the general living standard was low. But yeah, I mean, if you expand too fast, these builders are not going to build houses of good standard. And
Yeah, and of course we're only a few years out from the Grenfell disaster, so I
exactly.
sometimes worry that this let's slash the red tape sometimes feels shocking to me.
Yeah, I mean, the housing problem has to be solved by the regulation and the more equal distribution of assets. I mean, that you cannot solve it by building more houses.
It seems a bit naive to me, but let's get back to your child in
It's
Korea. So you're interested, so it's my fault. You're interested in economics. And you decide that you moved to in the UK when you were 18?
No. Actually, I went to university in Korea.
Okay, in Seoul.
Yeah, so we studied economics, and yeah, some professors were different, but most of the professors were just teaching this equilibrium models. Yeah,
The similar models to what I would have learned when
exactly. Yeah,
math, yeah.
mathematically less sophisticated, but
Okay.
the same idea. Yeah.
Okay, so just these are like basically very mathematically complex
Yeah.
mathematical equilibrium models. Not so much stuff on the history of economic thought, perhaps.
Yeah, we had a course in the history of economic
And
thought.
you don't mind me asking, what years would you have been studying in
Yeah,
Korea?
so I entered university in 1982
Okay.
and graduated in 1986 and came to England in the summer of 86 to start my
Okay, just
master's
before I was
here.
born, a few
That's
months before I was
yeah,
born.
I'm old. So when I Yeah, I entered the university. Most of the professors were, teaching this the abstract
In
equilibrium.
Seoul.
Yeah, Seoul National University, and many of my the friends couldn't take it seriously, because this huge upheaval going on outside the classrooms,
Yeah.
economic development, export success, political repression.
Yeah.
In 1980, the second military government committed this massacre in actually my father's hometown, the killing thousands of people who are protesting against the coup d'etat. And
Okay.
so a lot of us got interested in finding out whether there's other way of thinking about the economics.
So you went to university and you were very interested in economics, and you were kind of almost amused by you're in university basically doing maths,
That's
and
right.
there's not much discussion of there's all of this crazy stuff happening. This
Exactly.
is, one of the great modern economic miracles, right? This period of Korean economic growth. So you kind of thought, I mean, I had a similar thing, really. Like you sort of you, I think sometimes people are really amazed when I tell them we don't talk about the housing crisis,
That's right.
and we don't talk about the cost of living crisis. What we do is maths, and I did my undergrad in the mid 2000s, and I did my postgrad 2017 to 19.
Yeah, and that while you are doing this, there's one of the biggest financial crises in the history of capitalism. And
But
many
I'm
professors.
kind of surprised to hear that even, this is 30 years earlier in Korea, you were also doing this very, very heavily mathematized
That's
sort of
right.
study. Okay.
Yeah, so I just wanted to study something different, and I found out that there were a few universities in England and the United States where you could study non-neoclassical economics, Marxist economics, development economics,
So
institutional
just to make
economics.
clear, we're talking you didn't want to do just this kind of very specific, heavily mathematized. That's what you mean when you say neoclassical.
I mean, already neoclassical economics was very heavily
Yeah.
mathematized.
So neoclassical is basically like the at the moment at elite universities, there's kind of one there's basically there's one kind of economics that you're taught, almost from my perspective, almost as if it's like physics, like a physical
That's
science.
right. So this is a particular approach to economics, which assumes that the world is made up of this selfish, rational individuals. And they, try to get ahead and compete with each other, and that's what generates wealth. And
And in particular, what I often talk about on this channel is that these models, these kind of large-scale, heavily mathematical models, they tend to use what they call representative
That's
aging,
right.
which means that rather than talking about we have whatever 60 million people in the UK or 40 million people in Korea, you just look at the average. You say, let's look at one guy, the average guy, the representative guy, which of course means
There's
there is no
more,
inequality. There's
exactly
no
by
inequality,
definition.
there's no distribution of wealth.
And
And you were
also,
studying the that was the same thing you would have been
yeah,
studying.
exactly. And I that I'm still the laughing when I remember that incident. These models that really came on stream in a major way in the 1980s,
Yeah.
because before it was more of a general equilibrium and that kind of stuff. And in my early days in Cambridge, someone was giving a seminar using this representative agent model.
Yeah.
He also added this assumption that this agent is non-infinitely lived.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear.
So
Yeah.
we are like looking at this guy, and one of us asked, "What does that mean, non-infinitely lived?" And another guy said, "Well, I guess it means that we all die in the end."
Yeah.
I mean, there's
Yeah.
no sense that of realism there. I mean, just whatever makes it mathematically neat
Yeah, I
is
wonder.
assumed.
So
And
you moved to Cambridge in 86
exactly,
to do your postgrad, master's,
that's right,
PhD.
master's and PhD. And then I studied with the Professor Bob Rothen, who was a famous Marxist economist.
Okay.
Although, I mean, he did lots of other things, and he
Yeah.
didn't insist that I follow his approach. So my approach is a bit different from him, but I really thank him for kind of showing me different types of economics and, you know, that teaching me how to kind of reconcile them if I have to. And
so you chose to go to Cambridge because you thought that Cambridge was teaching like a more like diverse range of of looking at economics?
Yeah, yeah. At that time, Cambridge was, of course, the bastion of Keynesian economics.
Okay. But, can you just quickly describe what that means to our viewers who might not
know? Keynesian economics is economics that was kind of invented by the early 20th century British economist John Maynard Keynes, who, well, like you, made a lot of money in the financial market. Yeah? He's one of few economists who actually makes that money in the financial market, because surprisingly, many economists that when they invest in financial market, they fail.
Not so surprising to me, but he was rooted in, so I think
so he's one of the best economists of all time. You know, exactly.
And he lived through the Great Depression.
That's right, yeah. So his argument was, look, you cannot treat the economy as a household, But that is the mistake that the current labor government is making. Yeah, we maxed out on our credit card. You know, we cannot spend more. Of course, you can.
He's basically saying, if you tax people, like tax working people more, and you don't, the government stops spending, you'll basically cause this kind of economic depression, which is there's not enough spending. Businesses will fail, then more people will lose their jobs.
That's right,
And, well, yeah.
Yeah, so his point was that, you know, that your income is my spending. You know? Yeah. My spending is your income.
Yeah? Although we're kind of in this weird situation in the UK now where we have a government that seems to want to spend, but is kind of not able to spend. And we'll discuss more in this.
Yeah.
But so basically, I think the point you're making is, at universities, especially elite universities, economics is kind of taught like there's this one way of doing things.
Exactly.
Which you're calling neoclassical, neoliberal, which is this very highly mathematized, rational individuals. We look at the averages, but there are other ways of thinking about things, like Keynesianism, Marxist economics. And you wanted to, I guess, study a wider variety. So that's why you went to
Absolutely, Cambridge. Cambridge was, you know, the neoclassical economics was not so dominant until the 1950s and 60s. But from the 70s, it started really pushing out other schools because they are more kind of accepting of the status quo. They don't ask awkward questions. Yeah. So it was really becoming dominant. But there was still in the 80s, a few places that here and there where neoclassical economics was not dominant.
And
Cambridge was one of those places.
Cambridge still like that now?
No.
Because I went to London School of Economics 2005-2008, and really, to be honest, I was not even really aware that there were other ways.
Exactly. That's how it is these days. And so I deliberately wanted to come to Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, I got accepted. But, you know, when I told people that I want to study in England, I mean, a lot of people in
Your,
Korea
like, friends in...
just couldn't understand it because, you know, we had no historical relationship with England. So studying abroad meant 90% going to the U.S. and maybe 5% to Germany, 5% to France.
Yeah.
Hardly anyone came to England.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, moreover, people thought that wanting to study anything other than the neoclassical, you know, it was a career suicide. Yeah. I mean, career hadn't even begun, but you know.
Yeah.
So,
so have you got any advice to, we sometimes get messages from young people who are studying economics or are interested in studying economics. Sometimes you even get messages from people who are really interested in the ideas that we talk about on this channel. We talk a lot about inequality. And they say, where can I learn about these things? Where should I study? Is it going to be a problem for me for like career advancement? What advice would you give to young people who are interested in studying economics and actually learning about the economy?
Yeah, I mean, it's getting more and more difficult to study economics in a kind of pluralistic way that accepts different theoretical approaches and try to learn the best from all of them. Because most universities will teach you a very, very narrow curriculum,
yeah,
and that completely dominated by mathematics. Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, a lot of people want to study economics because they want to understand inequality, you know, cost of living crisis,
yeah,
financial crisis, and then they go to the university and they don't learn any of those. And then they do math for 3 years and
yeah,
they
yeah.
graduate. You know?
Maybe you could speak a little bit, because you were teaching at Cambridge for quite a long time, right? And you've been teaching at, sorry for the last, so you've been an economics professor and teacher at universities for a number of years. My experience of studying economics is when I did my undergrad, I was at LSE. It's a very elite university.
Yeah,
so lots of wealthy students. The truth is, for me, I found the majority of students there on the undergrad, to be honest, I think they were not, and I include myself in this, we were not really that interested in the economy, really. We were there because we thought, I think rightly to some degree, that economics, especially at an elite university like LSE, was a way to get a well-paid job.
It is, yeah.
So how what would, is that what you were seeing when you were at Cambridge as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, you know, I mean, there are different people. So, even in Cambridge, I would say, you know, 30% of the students were quite interested in the real world problems.
Yeah.
And Cambridge,
it's funny it's quite a small minority, that's right, but that's the same. I think LSE is probably slightly less.
Yeah, to be fair, Cambridge still offers a slightly more diverse
curriculum
than the LSE.
Yeah.
It used to be actually very real world oriented and diverse and so on until about 2005. Yeah. And then there's a major curriculum reform that made it very mathematical. And that's another story, but But the problem is that even for those 30%, 35%, I mean,
the nature of the study,
ability to think about the economy is beaten out of them.
I think your gestures are correct. So for me, when I did my undergrad, I was not interested in economics, really, other than its ability to get me a good job. Yeah. And that was almost everyone at LSE was like that. But then I went back to a master's at Oxford, 17 to 19. And that, what's interesting about that is the master's is not really like necessary to get a good job.
That's
if you have
true.
A good undergrad. Yeah. So then that means that some of the people who did the master's, a much bigger percentage of them were kind of interested in economics. But of course, they've all had this experience of you go to do your undergrad and maybe you go in quite naively thinking, I'm going to learn about the economy. Uh-uh. But the actual experience is, you have to do a lot of very, very difficult, essentially algebra exams, but algebra and calculus exams. And, you know, this is just like complicated maths. Yeah. And then those exams are really hard.
Yeah.
So then you don't, unless you're like super smart, you don't really have
time to do anything else.
Yeah, you don't have time to step back and be like, well, you know, does it make sense that we don't look at have any wealth distribution in the model? You don't really have, you know, you need to be, and also if you were to think, ask those questions, who do you ask them to?
Mm.
You know, I was at Oxford. Oxford had one guy who looked at inequality.
Mm.
Was his name Tony Atkinson?
Yeah.
And he died one
That's
year before
right.
I entered. Yeah, so I applied.
He was a very influential economist in the field of inequality studies. I think Piketty was quite impressed.
Yeah. So by the time Atkinson, I got there, there was not even anybody to speak to about inequality. And you know, you have to study really hard. And, you know, I didn't really care about my grades in masters. Yeah. But, you know, it does whip it out of you. Because if you have to do so much math and it's difficult.
Yeah.
And it kind of whips out anyone who actually wants to ask these big questions. It's like, well, everyone else is doing 100 hours a week of math.
Yeah.
And you're sitting around asking stupid questions.
That's right. Yeah,
so I think it does kind of whip. And I think it was really, really sad. Like, I thought the smartest kids on that Oxford postgrad course,
yeah,
they all dropped out of economics. Mm-hmm. Because it was like, well, the guys were curious.
Yeah.
It was so clear there is no space here for people who are curious about the economy.
Yeah, this conversation reminds me about what the radical Keynesian economist John Robinson said. I mean, Robinson was one of the few...
was she at
prominent, female economist. Yeah. Was a big name in the Keynesian economics. I mean, she should have got greater recognition, but she was very left-wing and asked a lot of awkward questions. And yeah, therefore, she was pushed back. But she once famously said that, "I had to learn to think because I wasn't all that good at math."
Yeah, yeah. I think sometimes
math becomes substitution for thinking.
I think that's a really good point. The obsession, it's insane. Because, you know, especially for that Oxford postgrad, you know, it's very difficult to get into this. Oxford's very prestigious university. These are really, really smart kids. And the reality of it is we spent 2 years locked in tiny windowless rooms, inverting matrices.
That's right.
It's insane. It's really, really is insane. But I think this, I want to make this point to our viewers. Because the point I often make is, you know, at the end of the day, these are the guys who are controlling the economy.
Yeah.
Who are making the decisions about the economy. And
it's quite worrying, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, the other point that I make is, and this is something I wanted to ask you about, was so when I did my undergrad, I think LSE is probably the worst for this, but I don't think it's unusual at all.
Mm.
The vast majority of the students wanted to be traders or at the very least to work in finance.
Mm.
And the vast majority of the students with the best grades did go on to become traders.
Yeah.
Does that mirror with what you've seen as a professor watching?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, you cannot blame them, you know.
I did it myself.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Going to trading... I mean, you will be making 5-10 times what you could be making in any other possible profession, civil service or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's natural, yeah. Yeah, but you know, the trouble is when you train people in this particular way, basically math, and then put them in charge of the economy, it's a bit like training people in, say, biochemistry, and then make them medical doctors, so it's related, so you have to understand the principles of biochemistry in order to understand human body and so on, but you need the clinical experiences, you should have actually looked at that actual patients to know how to diagnose them.
This is the big thing that I feel is missing, and to be honest, it's why I was impressed when I went to give your lecture series, which is, I think that from my personal experience, first of all, these guys who study economics at a high level, they're smart guys. They're very good. To be honest, they're very good at maths.
Yeah.
But I think there's really a lack of being able to, or even in a sense, thinking that's a thing you should do, step back and look at what you're doing in a sort of big picture sense.
Yeah.
I always remember when I was at Oxford, we had one lecture and, there was a discussion of like the aftermath to the 2008 crisis, which the recovery was much weaker than everybody predicted. And they were saying, we don't know why. And I put my hand up and I asked this guy, okay, well, why do you think it was?
Mm.
And he said, and I think this is one of the funniest things I've ever heard. He said, we're not sure why, but we think it was because of an exogenous shock to consumption savings preferences, which is... what this means, I have to explain this to the audience, right? Yeah, exogenous is a technical term in economics modeling, which means something outside of the model has changed.
That's right.
So I've asked him, why do you think, you know, this is a real thing that happened in the real world. God. Why do you think the recovery was so weak? And he has said, without like a hint of irony, we think something outside the model changed. And that is crazy. But I think it shows exactly when you make a guy do so much maths in the model, they forget that the model is not the real world. And when you reach the point that you start explaining things in the real world by using technical terms, saying something outside the model has changed, I think this captures like exactly what has gone wrong. Maddest thing is, nobody in the hall even laughs. You know, they just think, they're just like, they. I think this form of like very, very intense forcing people to do maths, it's almost like a brainwashing.
That's right. No, I mean, first of all, you know, that what this guy was implicitly saying was suddenly people didn't want to spend.
Yeah, this is hold on.
Why? Some, I don't know, alien overlord.
Came in, changed the world.
Yeah, that's right. Came and changed people. I mean, that's so stupid. But secondly, even if that is the case, then why are you not putting that into your model? Like, you know, I mean, unfortunately, this is now kind of verging on becoming a theology, you know.
I mean, I don't know if you realize.
Always right.
I know you're not on social media. Yeah. There is a clip of you kind of going viral on social media. Are you aware of this?
Well, yeah, my son, who's who's working in the Royal Institution, he's a biologist, but even he saw it.
People keep sending it to me, of you basically saying, like, and I think it's a really good point, and I think it's totally true.
Like it or not, economics has become a bit like Catholic theology in medieval Europe. Yeah? It has basically become the language of the rulers. Yeah? So if you don't speak economics, you cannot participate in any debate. Yeah?
Unless you're able to speak in this language, use these terms, you're basically not allowed to have an opinion. And exactly. It kind of locks, to be honest, like it locks poor people out of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. No, this scary parallel with Catholic theology in medieval Europe.
Yeah.
So that theology at the time was justifying whatever is going on in the world. Yeah.
Yeah.
And famine and the exploitation, you know, abuse of power, whatever, it's all in the God's will. Yeah. Today, whatever is going wrong in the world is justified by economics.
Must be what is best for
exactly,
Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Best of all possible worlds. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that to make it worse.
And they use that term a lot in economics. Well, they use the first best optimal.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you read Candide by Voltaire?
Yeah.
So it's a book, it influenced me a lot in my book, where he talks about this. By Voltaire hundreds of years ago.
He says
that back in the day, they justified everything by saying, if it wasn't supposed to be like this,
that's right,
God wouldn't have made it like this.
This must
be the best of all possible worlds, or God would have made it differently. Yeah. And economics uses sometimes similar language.
Yeah.
They say like the first best optimal outcome. If it wasn't supposed to be like this, the economy wouldn't have made it this way. But what I want to, the point which I make a lot on this channel is, if you reach high levels in this debate about how we should run the economy, how we should manage the economy, so if you become a prestigious academic, or if you become a high level politician, or if you become working in the central bank, or even high level media, you're quite rich by that point. And then what you have is a group of rich people basically refusing to allow poor people into the conversation because they're saying, sorry, you can't speak the maths, saying we think nothing should change.
Exactly.
As a way of justifying a system which, from where I'm standing, appears to make the rich richer every year.
Yeah.
And is crushing
the standards. We have to remember, you know, during the medieval times, the Vatican did not allow the Bible to be translated into vernacular languages. It all had to be in Latin.
Yeah.
So most people couldn't read Latin. And therefore, they had to just take their priest word the face value. Yeah.
This is basically why the Daily Mail has run four stories on me in four consecutive days. Because
you are dangerous.
What I'm trying to do on this channel, and I think it's also a lot of what you're trying to do in the work that you do, but also your books, which are very accessible to ordinary people, is you're trying to explain what's happening to ordinary people in a language they can understand. And I talk about a lot on this channel. What I think is happening is that the distribution is changing. The wealth distribution is changing in front of us. Ordinary people are getting poorer. The rich and the very rich are getting richer. And I think if people, you know, I've said it a lot on this channel. What I see my mission as is really quite simply getting people to understand what is happening.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because if people understood what is happening and also what's going to happen. So in my opinion, and I don't know how much of our videos you've watched, I think this crisis of wealth inequality will get worse. I think it's already decimated the working classes in the West. I think it's starting to decimate the middle class. You're seeing how it's basically impoverishing the government. And that is happening in a context of rapidly growing wealth of the richest.
Yeah, and now, I mean, in places like the US, although it's happening in other countries at a lower level, you know, now this blatant money politics, yeah?
Yeah, well, I saw on the news this morning we had Elon Musk offering people $1 million if they voted his way. Yeah. Well, this is another point I like to make a lot, which is distribution of wealth is distribution of power. And it's control over resources, but it's also control over the media. It's also control over the politicians.
Exactly. Now we are in a downward spiral because it's feeding into each other. So the more inequality, economic inequality, gives more power to these rich people.
Yeah. Which they can then use to take more power.
That's right.
I talk about this a lot, actually. I talk about basically these dynamics which you're talking about, which is the more power they have, the quicker they can take the rest of the power, which means they will then have more power.
Exactly.
And I think that this is the kind of spiral that we are in. And I'll be honest, I speak about it a lot. I'm really worried about where this goes, like at the first level in terms of living standards, but also in terms of politics. Because, well, first, I suppose I'll ask you this question. Mm. I think, unfortunately, that unless we get some change on taxation inequality, which I don't think we will get, at least in the short term, I think living standards for the West, for the working class, for the middle class, will continue to decrease.
Yeah,
do you think that's likely?
You have so-called Labour government cutting benefits, disability benefits of all things.
I think unless, and you know, I'm trying to get some influence with the Labour Party, obviously the government of this country. Why do you think they're so reluctant to discuss taxing the richest?
Well, I mean, a charitable interpretation is that they are scared of the financial market. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know.
Yeah, but I think
if you borrow a lot, so I think at the moment we're in this space where they want to borrow. It's just borrow. Well, if you borrow from the financial markets, you know, you are essentially borrowing from the rich.
Yeah.
If borrowing is your only plan, then you are a slave to the financial markets. You know, if my plan is to borrow from you, then I need you to agree to that.
Yeah, yeah.
If my plan is to tax you, I don't need you to agree to that. Yeah. So I think really the way to break out of that fear of financial markets is to start talking about taxation. And, and well, I'll tell you what I think. You didn't ask, but I'll tell you what I think. Mm-hmm. I think these guys, they're being pressured by their rich funders. I think they don't want to push back on it, basically. But I think also, I think there is a real lack of economists looking at things like the distribution.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I think that economists in the Labour Party, they are still living in this mental cage built by Margaret Thatcher. So the high taxation for the rich is bad, you know, the private ownership of everything is good, that kind of. I mean, unfortunately, I'm sure that they are uncomfortable with it, but they haven't been able to develop a counter narrative. Let's look at some facts. You know, in the 1960s and 70s, Britain was one of the most equal countries in the world. People don't often realize it. The country was growing faster than what it is has been growing in the last 30 years, despite having, you know, top income tax rate of 80%. In the US at the time, the top income tax rate was even higher, 90%. But it was growing much faster than what it is doing today. You know. At least try to use those historical facts to develop some counter narrative. But since they haven't developed this counter narrative and basically given up on the taxing the rich, taxing wealth and so on. What do they do? There's only one way to spend more, which is borrowing, which creates the problem that you just talked about.
I think it's kind of the same thing which I said before, which is like a bit of an inability. And I think maybe we kind of teach this a little bit in the way that we educate people in university now, an inability to step back and look at the big picture. And the big thing which I often talk about was, you know, and the reason I started my channel was at the beginning of COVID, it was very clear that the UK government and the US government and basically all Western governments were going to give a huge amount of money out. And the UK deficit is £1 trillion. And all I wanted to know, because my background is distribution, inequality, who is going to get that £1 trillion? That's the only thing I wanted to know. And because the US number is, I think, $13 trillion, huge numbers. You're obviously going to change the distribution here. You're obviously going to change the distribution. But I think it was so amazing. Just nobody asked. Nobody. And I think I honestly think it goes back to the way that we teach our economic students. This way that we just whip them in to do the maths. Don't question the model. Don't think about the big picture. And then you reach a point where, we can give out £1 trillion. The Americans can give out $13 trillion. And because our models never question distribution, nobody even asked where it's going to end up. I think it's
amazing. This extra money was basically given to banks and other financial institutions, which refused to give it to productive enterprises that need this money for investment. Give to ordinary consumers, citizens. I mean, why couldn't they do it with more taxation? If you think generally high level of taxation is not a good thing, at least you can have emergency taxations. I mean, a lot of countries did that. Wartime and in the post-war reconstruction, they would occasionally impose a special levy or whatever percent on the rich people for 5 years or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you mention wartime periods because, the channel has really been growing and it's becoming really popular. And, this argument of why you're not taxing the rich is growing and growing and growing and growing. And I think we actually made some good progress because for a long time we would get these kind of economic pushbacks. It's not good for the economy. It's not good for the economy.
There's no evidence for that.
No, there's not. But increasingly people are not believing that. But the argument against has kind of shifted into this but it's not possible. You can't tax rich people. This kind of fatalistic, things always get worse. You can't do anything. But then if you look back at, especially the Second World War in Europe, in the West, there was a massive decrease in wealth inequality.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's obviously doable. I don't know, have you got anything you can say about whether it's possible and also why so many people are so quick to say it's impossible when we have this historical example?
Well, I think one reason why it is more difficult than before is that downward spiral that we had talked about. Increasing inequality feeding into increasing inequality of power and democracy being more and more constrained. So that's the one reason why I think it is more difficult to do that now than possible in the 1950s or 60s.
This is a really good point because I think people push back and they say it's impossible because you can't do it technically. But the Second World War proves it's technically possible. The truth is, what makes it very, very difficult, in my opinion, is that control of the media and the control of politicians because whenever I go on TV or radio to campaign for wealth taxes, I'm always doing it for free and I'm self-funded. And I'm up against somebody who works for a think tank funded by billionaires. And sometimes people, if you wonder why there's not more voices like me in the media, because who funds it? The billionaires are actively paying for people to go on TV, go on the radio and say it's impossible to tax the rich. Who is paying for people like me to make the counter argument? Basically nobody. So that shows you, really, the way they block it is by fighting that narrative battle and winning that narrative battle.
But as Nelson Mandela once said, it always looks impossible until it is done. We can do it. We have to do it. We have to start somewhere. Change the narrative, but maybe put more pressure on your politicians. And do more math economic literacy campaign so that more people know about these things like you are doing in a very, very effective way. I mean, we have to change this.
Yeah.
And it can be done. Okay, maybe the 90% is the too much, yeah.
Yeah.
But why should it be the 40% or the 50%? It could be the 60, 70, yeah. Yeah.
And I always talk about how it's not even necessarily just about what rates we tax income. You know, we have these very, very wealthy families.
That's right.
We have they don't pay income
tax.
Tax
wealth. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I think this is the big...
Yeah, they don't have income. In
yeah.
The
their income
sense.
Is not classed
yeah.
as income.
Exactly.
But, you know, they do receive billions yeah. of pounds in their lifetime. Yeah. I think often what is often done is when I say I want to tax the rich, my opponents try to convince the public, that means you. And they try to ignore, you know, there are families out there with hundreds of millions, billions of pounds of yeah. wealth. Their wealth is growing and growing and growing. And they're squeezing people out.
Yeah.
They're squeezing people out. This is the worry I have. But I think I look at the growth of this narrative, the massive growth in support for it. I think we can win the public battle for it. But I think we need more support from economists, which is why I'm always glad to hear you doing the work you're doing. I'm hoping we get more young people going into economics to push this narrative. I think that's really good. I guess I would like to end on just asking you. I can often be a little bit pessimistic and a little bit depressing, but I do this work because I think we can make things better. So at these times when living standards are falling and we have increased political turbulence, what is it that gives you hope for our future as a society and our future as an economy?
Yeah, well, I try to live by the dictum of the Italian Marxist philosopher Antonio Gramsci, who said that we need the pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will, yeah? Yeah, so you have to be realistic about what can be achieved at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, so that makes you pessimistic because the debts kind of stack so much against the ordinary people. But in the long run, you know, the world has changed hugely. Yeah? If changes were impossible,
yeah,
you know, we will be still living in the society with the slaves and most people are,
yeah,
you know, the tied to their land and do not have any freedom to choose their profession. You know, the women will not be allowed to vote. You know, there'll be the explicit racial discrimination. But these things all have changed because people have fought for it. Yeah. So if you take the perspective of 50 years, 100 years, we can change this. Yeah.
I think that's the key thing is, because people fought for it.
Yeah.
Because people fought
exactly,
for it.
Yeah.
I think we can. I'm fighting for it. I know you're doing your bit. thank you very much. Thanks for coming on the channel. That's great for me. Is there anything you wanted to, bring up or anything
you
want to speak about?
I mean, I'm very honored to be the first outside speaker in your great series. Yeah, I mean, please get other speakers so that you can diversified what you're doing is great, but we need kind of different people coming into
I think
different perspectives.
It's important for us to have more economists, I think, because this channel is like, it's getting so popular with the public, but you know, we have all of these rich posh guys, I'll never work, and you know, we live in a very class focused society, and I think I'm from a working class background, and I think one of the reasons why the channel is popular is because the country is from a working class background. I'm happy to hear that. But fact is, the guys who control the levers of power, they're normally not from working class backgrounds.
Yeah, but there are some kind of good economists working on these issues. You know, get Piketty.
Yeah, you know, Zucman, I think we'll reach out. I think Piketty and Zucman are great. The French economists work on inequality. Thank you very much for coming on. Hajin has not asked me to recommend his books, but I think Hajin has a lot of books out. His recent one is Edible Economics, which is here on the table. He didn't ask me to do this, honestly. He didn't. I think Hajin writes really well economics in a way that is enjoyable and relatable to ordinary people. So if you're watching and you find economics inaccessible and you want, I obviously haven't written any books about economics, like straight books about economics, but I think Hajin's books are really good. And if you've got questions for Hajin, send them in and maybe we'll get him on again someday. Basically, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For coming on. I really enjoyed this time.
Great.
And, good to see you again. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for your support. Keep watching. Share the videos with your friends, with your mum. It's all about stopping the economy from getting worse. It's about taxing wealth and at work. Support us. Thank you very much.